This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, the Watts Writers' Workshop. Tonight's guest, novelist-screenwriter Bud Schulberg, who began this successful literary experiment in the aftermath of the Watts riots. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-4300. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. On Friday the 13th of August in 1965, the Watts section of Los Angeles exploded into violence. From the ashes, the voices of Watts came into existence because, in the words of Bud Schulberg, and we quote, "There in the pool room lurks the nuclear physicist, lost to drug addiction through criminal neglect and want of motivation. And there on the street corner drifts the young poet who flunked English in the 10th grade. Think of finding these young men of mysterious depths, of talents neglected, before the poet or the lute player goes to his pauper's grave. He may be only one among 10,000, but he may find that he speaks for 20 million, unquote. These are the words of Bud Schulberg, the novelist, screenwriter, who created and sustained the Watts Writers' Workshop, proving that the pen is mightier than the sword. One of Watts Writers' Workshops involved many major creative contributions to the American culture. The Douglas House Theater, the book From the Ashes, a collection of 18 arresting anthologies and works that perhaps would not have been published otherwise, and Big Time Buck White, the play that the New York Times says, and we quote, has arrived for a long, long stay in New York, unquote. Our Night Call guest in Beverly Hills, California, is Bud Schulberg, and joining us for the second half hour will be the director and star of Buck White, Dick Williams, here in New York City. Mr. Schulberg, good evening, sir, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Del.
Mr. Schulberg, we'll begin our conversation tonight by asking, what made you decide that you wanted to start the Watts Writers' Workshop?
Well, it's a very difficult question, certainly for me to answer, because I didn't really decide it. I was drawn by the fires that were burning in Watts, and I was drawn to go and take a good look for myself and to try to find out why this happened. People just don't burn down their own homes or their own stores or their own streets without, I guess, some reason. And so I went and I walked and I talked to people, those who would talk to me, and very frankly, not too many would. Because I was white, and out of this walking around and talking, I got the idea to try to set up it actually wasn't a workshop then, I just put a sign up on the bulletin board in a settlement house that I would teach a class in writing. And it was out of that, after the curfew was lifted in 65, about 3.5 years ago, that we got started. But I didn't decide anything. It sort of decided me.
Well, considering that your prominence as a member of the writing colony of Hollywood and where you've done such successful things of What Makes Sammy Run and screenwriter of On the Waterfront and some of the other novels that you've written, was there any relationship in the actual live things taking place in Watts and perhaps things that you have written about?
Well, yes, in a way I think that there was. I've always been involved or felt some sense of involvement when I was in college up at Dartmouth. I was mixed up in a... I was the editor of the paper there, and I was mixed up in a marble strike, and I got actually very a strong feeling for the rebel longshoremen who were trying to throw the mob off the back on the waterfront, and I tried to write articles about the actual situation long before we ever got into the movie. So I guess there's some relationship, yes.
Well, I'm curious. There are other successful writers in Hollywood and other successful screenwriters. After you had gotten the Watts Writers Workshop together and was beginning to enjoy some success, did other successful writers attempt to join you or to give you any kind of assistance, or were they attracted to what you were doing?
Well, I would say yes. Not in the same... Excuse me, don't. Not exactly in the same way, not in the direct physical way, but I certainly received kind of moral support, which was extremely helpful, and it also led to some of the first actual material support out here in Los Angeles. Irving Stone helped me because he read in the Los Angeles magazine a short piece I wrote, and also three young poets, all under 21, three young interesting poets, all out of Watts. And he phoned me the next day and said, "I just find this incredible that these young men can write this well." And out of that, he formed a group, an early group of other writers, Irving Wallace and the Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Nevins and others, that did, in a sense, support me here on the West Coast. On the East Coast, John Steinbeck was very helpful to me, and Ilya Kazan and others. I did get support. Yes, I did. I didn't. It was not easy to find someone who would do exactly what I did. Jimmy Baldwin wrote from Istanbul that he was for me and sent funds and was on our advisory board. And I would say I had fairly good support, but it is always difficult to get someone to just go right down and do that job if they're busy with their things.
Why did you feel that blacks wanted to write about the conditions of Watts as well as their own conditions and the problems that they've had in their own environment, as opposed to feeling that some blacks were more contented with giving vent to their feelings by burning and by pillaging and other things of that nature? Why did you feel that they would prefer to write about it?
It was a hunch. It was a strong hunch that I had. I've had also my life. I've had ever so many black friends. Some of them have been in the arts, and some not. I've been tied up with prize fighting a great deal of my life, and I've had many friends who were prize fighters. And just out of the whole experience, I knew that there was an awful lot to say, and I knew that if you have enough to say, that you're going to be able to somebody will finally be able to put it down. So I had a pretty strong hunch that if I asked the group, say even out of a pool room, how do you feel about being in jail, and how do you feel about the police department, or how do you feel about the conditions, what made this happen, I don't think it would, honestly, Dale, I don't think it takes a genius to think that somebody is going to put down something that's pretty true and convincing, and that's, I think that is what happened. We found that we got awfully good material in fiction, both in fiction and in playwriting and nonfiction as we found when we, I think, as the whole public found and the whole country found when we finally put put out that book, and actually we've have other writers who have come along since that time.
Has the writer's workshop influenced the people in Watts in any way?
Well, I would say that I think so. I don't know to what extent. I don't want to claim, I wouldn't want to claim more for it than it is, but I think that people are very proud of it in Watts. And I think that also it has set up a kind of a chain reaction, so that other people are also doing their thing, and they're reading their poetry, and they're putting up their theaters, and I think that there has been some example set. I think that it has made a contribution to a new image of Watts, and of the to the, in a sense, the sense of pride in being somebody, which incidentally is also difficult for outside people, I think, to understand, and difficult for many white people to understand. Very closely connected with the actual burning and what some people call riot and others call revolt. It sort of says, "Look at me." And you can say that in many ways. You can say it in a poem, like Johnny Scott, who's a very talented member of our group, is now up at Stanford, or Jimmy Sherman, or many others. You can say it in a poem, or you can say it by burning down a market.
Well, the members of the workshop, do they enjoy any kind of position in the Watts neighborhood now, the Watts community, as examples of what black people can do if they decide to help themselves, or are they enjoying some kind of artificial position as pseudo leaders, or what is their image right now in the?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think that's a hard question. I think that those who are standing up and who are expressing themselves, either some of them have moved out, in a sense have been able to get jobs in the commercial scene in television. Others are able to write columns in the local newspapers like the Sentinel, something like that. Others just are part of, I don't mean just in that sense, but are sort of singing their songs, whether it's in the park or in some school, and I think without any doubt that they have won a sense of place in Southeast Los Angeles.
This is Nightcall in New York, and tonight our guest is Mr. Bud Schulberg, and we are discussing the Watts Writers Workshop, the organization that he started following the Watts riots out in California about 3 years ago. And during the second half hour, we'll be talking with a young man who is currently appearing as the star, and I think also the director of a play that came out of the Watts Writers Workshop, which is Big Time Buck White. We'll be talking with Mr. Dick Williams, who incidentally is also one of the leading performers in the new motion picture, Uptight. So let's take our first call tonight. We'll go all the way out. We have Mr. Schulberg calling in from California. We'll take our first call from California. Mr. Friedakowski is hearing Night Call over KOGO-FM. Mr. Kowski?
Friedakowski.
How are you, sir?
How are you tonight?
Fine, thank you. Where are you calling from, sir?
A little town about 20 miles north of San Diego, Poway. P-O-W-A-Y.
Is that T or P?
T, like in Prince.
I see. Poway, California, right. Your question, sir. Thank you for calling.
I don't have any. I couldn't follow any too well there.
You couldn't...
Listen, I have a vague idea. How do you suppose the Watts riot and the rest of the riots that have been pretty well suppressed, seemingly, to me, from the public, how do you suppose these riots compare with the... Are you familiar with the beginning of the Reformation, Martin Luther's Reformation? How do you suppose it compares the activity, the amount of it going on right now with the beginnings of the Reformation? Is that any good?
Well, it sounds kind of deep and sounds kind of interesting, but since you said that you can't hear us too well, I'm going to ask you to hang up, and I'm going to ask Mr. Schulberg to respond to you right after station identification.
Okay? Fine.
Right. Thank you so much for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
Ever since I joined the Army, one buddy or another is always asking me what I really want, as if my being black made things different for me. It doesn't. I just want people to remember I fought for my country and never forget it. I won't. When I get out of uniform, I want to go home to more than nothing. I don't want sympathy or charity. I want to make it on my own. I want a decent job. I want to be able to get married and support a family. I don't expect miracles, but I won't settle for a broom.
It isn't easy to get by in cities these days, for blacks or whites. Our cities need help, your help. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder. Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest, novelist, screenwriter Bud Schulberg about self-help for the black artist. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And prior to station identification, we had a listener who had called in from Poway, California, and if our question is correctly, if we can recall it, and we'll try to state it as close as we can, he wanted to know whether or not there was a comparison between the riots in Watts and the Reformation under Mr. Martin Luther. So, Mr. Schulberg?
Yes, sir.
Yes, is there any kind of comparison?
Well, I would say that I don't think that they can be compared, but only in a sense related. That the whole dream, that dream, impossible or not, of Martin Luther King was to reform society without violence. In the pursuit of that dream, he died violently, and And the tragedy of it, of course, is that it made many, many young people and black people feel that he and his idea of a peaceful reformation of society had come to a very dead end. And I think that's something of what's facing us in this happy or unhappy new year.
In your discussions during the workshop, where did you ever have the occasion to have the writers or the potential writers to discuss the problems of the riots? Did they go into any area like this?
Yes, they certainly did. Of course, they did. At the very beginning, it was uppermost on their minds, and I think that some of the best work that came out of the first year of the class was based on the riot. Johnny Scott wrote a poem called Watts 66, which was a direct expression of why. And young Jimmy Sherman wrote a very interesting piece, which appeared in the Antioch Review, which incidentally gave us after the book From the Ashes a special issue, in which he wrote about why I revolt, and I thought he expressed himself very well. It's the kind of piece that I think many people ought to read. It was a release of energy. It was a release of tensions. It was a release of frustrations. And then after it was over, he writes, he went back to his room, having been, in a sense, in the street for a number of days, and sat there for a week, just in his own small room, and just contemplated and tried to figure out why this happened, and why he had taken part in it, and even why he enjoyed it. And I would say that a good deal of the stimulus for our writing came out of that uprising.
Did you find a change in their approach, in the class's approach, as they became more involved with their writing, as their writing became more polished, as they gained more confidence in their writing? Was there a new direction? Was there a new outlook? Did they have a new perspective?
Well, again, Dell, I would say that we're dealing with, when you say they, we're dealing with individuals, and I think that there were some who saw an outlet for themselves in becoming professional writers, some who felt that they could actually perfect their technique to become, say, TV writers or film writers, and we have had some success in that field, and others who did develop, but were still, in a sense, staying within their own kind of bag of protest. But I would say that it would be hard to generalize, because we're talking about human beings. We're talking about very special kind of creative human beings.
All right, we'll take our next call, Mr. Schulberg, from Detroit, Michigan. Mr. Dudley is hearing Night Call over WJLB. Mr. Dudley?
Yes?
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Your question?
Yes, I'd like to know, do you think that the plan you had in Watson worked in other riot torn areas?
You mean the writer's workshop?
Yes.
Whether it could work in other areas?
Yes.
What is your feeling about that, Mr. Schulberg? Do you think there can be Watts Writers' Workshop in other areas, and are you aware of any such projects?
Well, yes, I think that there is no doubt about it, and in a sense, one thing that convinces us is that after this workshop began to make some progress and some impact, we began to get letters from many places, far off and in the area, like Long Beach, San Bernardino, and we started to go there first because our funds were limited, and we started to the closest places, and we went to Long Beach, and there is now a branch of the Douglas House, which, by the way, is named for Frederick Douglass, who was a slave who ran away and taught himself to read and to write and became a powerful figure in and after the Civil War. And there is a Douglas House now in Long Beach, in what we call the Forgotten Ghetto, because people always think of Watts, but there are ghettos all over this country, pockets which are neglected. And there is one which is really flourishing right now in Long Beach. And we've also had a small start in San Bernardino, and we have a southeast Los Angeles branch, and we also have a Chicano or Mexican American branch, and we're just opening a center in San Francisco, and we feel that if our funds are sufficient, because unfortunately there's only that old devil money, we have to pay the rent, and we need secretaries, and we need someone to direct it. But I think with that, the response has been so great that I have no doubt that what has been done and achieved in Watts can be done in absolutely every part of this country.
Mr. Dudley, thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. And coming in on our next line will be Mr. Dick Williams, who's the director and star of Big Time Buck White, which is a black power satire, and for the blacks it's a celebration of the black spirit, and for whites it's an opportunity to become involved in the black experience. And as we said earlier in our opening, that New York Times, among many of the very fine reviews that Big Time Buck White has received, it says that Big Time Buck White will be with us for a long time. So let's welcome Mr. Dick Williams. Mr. Williams?
How are you?
Thank you so much for calling, sir.
Thank you for calling me.
And Mr. Schoberg is on the line, so perhaps you'd like to say hi to him.
Hi, Brett. How are you?
Dick, I'm just fine, and I'd like to congratulate you on your success.
Thank you, sir.
I read the reviews. I was delighted with the reviews.
Thank you, sir.
I think it's a great job that you did. I also saw a tight the other evening, and I thought it was quite a film, and I was also impressed with your performance there. So for us, it's been quite a Dick Williams week.
Thanks a million, Buck.
I haven't had a chance yet to see Big Time Buck White, but I did have a chance to see a preview of Uptight, and I kind of share Mr. Schoberg's feelings about the picture, and especially your performance, and I want to congratulate you, too, and it'll be opening in New York in another week or so, so we'll be awaiting the word of the lay critics.
Thanks a
million. How has the show gone so far for you?
Well, it's gone pretty well. We've performed the full houses, even through the previews, and the New York audience is kind of an exciting audience. You know, they're much more theater-oriented than the audiences in Hollywood, California, and much, much more than audiences in Watts. And I think of the three audiences, the most electrifying are the audiences in Watts, because I think some of the people that we performed before had a previous experience, hadn't had the theatrical experience. And so, you know, Watts doesn't have a movie house, and most of the people have to go in outlying areas of Watts to watch a film.
In about 2 months, we hope to have one, Dick, but we're fighting hard, but go on.
Yeah, but one of the things, you know, that I notice about the black audiences in Watts is that, you know, they're used to talking back to the film. Like, for instance, if you go to the Manchester or one of the theaters around, that's torn down now, but there would be a constant dialogue between audience and the film, you know. And they join in much freer. Well, in Watts, it's like that, too. They come up on stage sometimes, and it makes for electrifying theater, I think.
They come up on stage?
Oh, yeah. They join into the activity. It becomes quite a thing. Each night, they show change.
So the performer can't remember his lines, may be in trouble sometimes.
Yeah, right. Well, the actors, they're pretty used to that, so they get along with it pretty well. We have a section in the play that's completely, you know, unimprovised at all, unscripted at all, you know, when the audience asks questions to Buck White. And so we've kind of gotten accustomed to that.
Mr. Williams, I want to ask you just one brief question before Mr. Schoberg leaves us, because he'll have to leave us in just about 60 seconds. But is it my understanding that Big Time Buck White came out of the Watts Playhouse, right? I mean,
yeah,
the Watts
right.
Workshop, rather.
This production of it, and I kind of inaugurated their new theater, the Frederick Douglass Theater, that was originally a supermarket, and then a burned-out, gutted-out supermarket, and then I think Warner Brothers came down and threw up a stage and partitioned off some offices, and now they've got a theater there, and they're doing some tremendous dynamic work at that workshop.
Mr. Schoberg, we want to thank you for being with us, and I know you have to leave us, and we certainly hate to see you leave.
Thank you, Dale, and to Dick, I was at the workshop last night, and we read a new play by Cal Wilson, and there was a great deal of enthusiasm, and I know that everybody down there just sends a big wave of Brussels to all of you and to David, and
give him my love.
I sure will.
And keep up the vital work.
We're going to try.
Okay.
Mr. Schoberg, thank you so much for being with us. This is Night Call in New York, and we'll be coming right back with Mr. Dick Williams, the director and star of Big Time Buck White, as we'll continue our conversation on the Watts Writers Workshop. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
Okay.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest novelist screenwriter Bud Schulberg after station identification. Next week on Night Call. a bishop of the Episcopal Church who believes you can communicate with the dead, the first vice president of the Republic of New Africa, the NAACP attorney who was fired for criticizing the Supreme Court, a doctor who wants to legalize abortion, and a Jew who says hurting Whitey doesn't help the black man. Monday, the Right Reverend James A. Pike, is there life after death? Tuesday, Milton Henry. He says Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina should be turned over to the black man right now. Wednesday, Lewis Steele. He says the 9 men in black think white. Thursday, Dr. Robert Hall. He wants to legalize abortion. And Friday, Nathan Perlmutter of the American Jewish Committee on Black Anti-Semitism. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest novelist screenwriter Bud Schulberg about self-help for the black artist. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we go into the second half hour of Night Call tonight, where we started off the first half hour talking with Bud Schulberg, the very fine Hollywood screenwriter and novelist, and the young man who's been behind the What's Writers Workshop. And during the last 5 minutes, we had a chance to talk to Mr. Dick Williams, who is the director and star of Big Time Buck White, which came out of that same workshop. So for the remaining half hour, we'll be talking with Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams, are you on the line?
Right here.
Right. Thank you again for staying with us.
Okay.
The reviews of Big Time Buck White has been very, very good. And as we said earlier, the New York Times, among other people, have stated that this particular production will be with us for quite some time, and we're happy about that. What is your opinion of the Watts Writers Workshop? You have been in contact with a number of the writers there, a number of the people. Could you give us like a brief capsule of your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, that it's a very vital area of Watts right now, along with some other workshops there, and that, you know, the tension runs deep and the emotions run high and hostilities are sometimes bare, but there's always that searching, exploring, you know, quality about it, experiencing thing, that there's a definite sense that something's happening, a sense of looking for new forms and new ways of communicating and ways of communicating out of a black ethos. I think it's a very vital area.
You're credited with stating that the theater must be larger than life. What do you mean by that?
I mean that it's not enough to recreate experiences that people ordinarily in their lives experience. You know, that besides being a place for entertainment, a place for engaging, you know, and a two-way communication, that it should be, that there should be some instruction in theater, that theater should carry a person further than where he was when he walked into it. And for that reason, I like theater that has to do with the audience, that deals directly with the audience, and I like new theater, too.
Well, in Buck White, you have an interesting question and answer period. Now, does this follow the production, or is this within the production itself?
It's within the production itself. There's an area, a couple areas where the audience, you know, stands up and asks questions, and sometimes it gets quite heated. Sometimes there's screaming across from one end of the meeting hall. I refer to the theater as a meeting hall. That's sort of an actor's reference. And sometimes there's quite heated things that go down in there.
Well, what do you hope to accomplish during this question and answer period?
Well, when the play is so designed that there is a great deal of comedy in the beginning of it, and all of a sudden people are laughing and they're having a good time because, you know, blacks are kind of ridiculing blacks among other people and other things, and all of a sudden the mood changes and it clears the air. It opens it, the audience, actor relationship, it brings them closer together, an aesthetic distance that breaks down. And, you know, oftentimes an audience member will forget that they're in a theater and that it's a play. They'll forget all about it being a play. It gets kind of wild in there.
Well, is it not possible that during this question and answer period that the performer answering a question may not actually be performing?
Well, yeah, that's really what happens in a way. The character Buck White is not very, very far from my own being, and so, you know, I don't have to go that far to achieve it. And the answers have to come out of a black reference, you know, someone who's had the ghetto experience and that moment by moment of being black, etc. And there's a kind of confrontation that happens in the theater that doesn't ordinarily happen outside the theater.
Well, isn't there some difficulty in stepping out from one role into another? And what about the reaction of the person who's asked the question? Does the person leave with the feeling that they've had an answer from Dick Williams or they've had an answer from Buck White?
I think they leave feeling that they've had some confrontations that they don't ordinarily have. That's part of the intention of the play, to bring blacks and whites into a direct confrontation. And out of the confrontation, you know, it goes different ways, different nights. You know, the audience in this particular play, the audience greatly influences, you know, the way the play runs. And they sort of set up the answers, you know, the questions for big time and big time answers. And
now, to some degree, the storyline in Buck White is that you attempt to portray some of the problems that black organizations face in trying to unite as a group.
Right.
What are some of the problems that face an organization? I think it's called BAD.
Yeah, BAD, and B-A-D. And that stands for Beautiful Hallelujah Days. Some of the problems that confront blacks when they try to unify, when they try to organize, is that, you know, the same problems that go down with whites when they try to organize, you know, there's bickering, and there, except that it goes down in a different way with blacks. There's bickering, there's the kind of struggle for a higher place in the organization and for more voice and for more power. And Big Time is kind of a unifying element. He's a kind of a black spiritual leader. And he's not involved in the bickerings that go on, but, you know, the bickerings that go on present themselves even in black churches. You know, if you've ever been to a Baptist voting on a Baptist church when they vote for offices, you'll know exactly what I mean.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our second guest tonight is Mr. Dick Williams, the director and star of Big Time Buck White, which opened in New York just about, about a week ago, into some very excellent notices. And he's calling in from New York, and if you missed the first half hour, we're sorry, because we had Mr. Bud Schulberg. So let's take our first call tonight on the second half hour from New York, a local call, Mr. Akin Wola, I hope my pronunciation is correct, and he's hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Your question, sir. Good evening.
Good evening, Brother Shields. Yeah, my name is Akin Wola, and I want to say that I really enjoy the program, firstly, that you're really cooking, you know.
Thank you, sir.
I dug the play, Big Time Buck White, and a first statement I would like to make is that I think, and you can comment on this, that the time now is that we cannot use satires on our problems that we have, like within the movement. And the question that I wanted to ask you was, do you think through traveling, I mean, and going to the different areas of the country and making this performance and getting questions and responses from the white audiences, do you see a change in attitudes, or is it still the same old trend? Do you think their attitudes really haven't changed any,
well,
meaningfully?
I think one of the things that the play does is that sometimes it breaks down that big barrier that a liberal places around themselves, you know, and oftentimes a person that will stand up and ask a question, you know, innocently, a well-intentioned liberal will ask a question, you know, what can he do to help? And then we'll begin dissecting the question and dissecting the person. The person finds out that at the root he is very prejudiced, except that he feels that because he isn't doing anything directly to help, to hurt black people, that he's not really involved in that at all. And, you know, as far as satires on blacks are, you know, if you turn on television or watch movies, you'll find satire after satire after satire on white people. My point is that black people shouldn't take their definitions of themselves from white people, that beneath the satirical black man is a very biting, vital force that need be utilized. For instance, the black stereotype that has grown up about black people being slow and slovenly and lazy and not willing to work with no aspirations. Now, that's from a white, very white point of view. You know, the black man, what the black man really was doing was that he was resisting in the only way that he could resist, you know, because he lived in a kind of time that we don't live in, where two blacks couldn't even congregate. And a lot of the resistance is in the spiritual songs that were sung, the gospel songs, that at root they were like communications, they were messages to other brothers and sisters. For instance, if a brother, say his father had been beaten with a whip, you know, almost all night, and he had gotten hold of a gun, and the people knew that they had a revolution planned for months later, and this brother might mess it up and get himself wiped out, plus his family wiped out. They might say, sing the song, one of these days we're going to lay down this heavy load, or walk together, children, don't you get weary. You know, and it was a way of blacks communicating with blacks without whites knowing about blacks. But at the root of it, I mean, what sense would there be in a black man working 18 hours and reaping nothing in return for it? You know, what would be the sense in him doing a good, energetic, aspiring job? You know, I think the stereotypes need to be re-examined. I think that that we're missing a whole great vital part of our heritage if we don't get beneath the words of, say, a Paul Lawrence Dunbar, you know, and beneath, and to find out their most essential communication as opposed to their superficial communication. Because like a guy like Dunbar, you know, who at one time was put down by blacks, and it was the reason why, because they used white standards to appraise black works. Well, underneath the level of the words in a writer like Paul Dunbar is a very vital communication for black people to stand up and demand and stand up and get what is rightfully due them.
Can I ask one more question, brother?
Sure.
And this was asked you the night I was there, and I didn't feel that it was a misunderstanding of the question, or maybe your answer just isn't in accord with my concept. But the question was, why do you consider yourself black when in actuality your skin color was not like real, like it wasn't a real black, concrete black thing?
My skin color?
Well, they were asking you this in reference to your skin color,
uh-huh.
You dig?
Uh-huh.
And to me, and I hope to you, blackness is, you know, like deeper than the skin. It's in the mind and concept.
Wow.
So
yeah,
would you...
Right. Well, you just answered the question right on the nose. You know, blackness is a kind of a philosophy, and it's one that, you know, I think the black man has, and it doesn't, you know, what the white done, it has done is that they have said that anyone from one drop of blood, black blood, to 10 billion drops of black blood is a black man, you know, and they discriminate, they discriminate equally, and so there are some very light black people, and I don't consider myself a very light black person, but there are some very light black people who don't, you know, recognize the fact that they're black. They, you know, they buy a house in a bourgeois area in the hills, and they sort of close themselves off from that kind of rising black giant that's rising in the black ghettos. And but you know, when they walk through Mississippi, they find out exactly who they are. You know, and if they become a millionaire and able to buy Rolls Royces, they realize that they can't drive those things through Louisiana and Arkansas and Alabama without being harassed. They're made conscious that when they try to go into places that white go, and they break their necks trying to get into them, that there is a difference, you know.
Right.
Like, you can't separate the skin color from, you know, that kind of oppression that's heaped upon every black man. It's much, much deeper than the color of the skin.
Okay, thank you very much, brother.
Thank you for calling.
I'm really surprised that I got a 9 here, brother Dale Shields, because I tried several times.
Never give up. Never give up.
Okay.
Thank you for calling. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest tonight, Mr. Dick Williams, a big-time Buck White, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest novelist-screenwriter Bud Schulberg after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call... Are movies better or worse than ever? And is the new movie rating system a good or a bad thing? Former Herald Tribune movie critic Judith Crist now plies her trade for NBC's Today Show TV Guide, and New York Magazine, and is considered one of the best and sharpest-tongued commentators on the motion picture in this country. Now there's something new in the movie business, an almost totally accepted industry-wide film rating system. One office that will rate movies for general audiences, mature audiences, 16-year-olds with parents, and none under 16 at all. Is this good, or does it smack of censorship? And how are our movies doing anyway? Are they better or worse than foreign films? Rating the movies, good, bad, and indifferent, with film critic Judith Crist, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest novelist-screenwriter Bud Schulberg about self-help for the black artist. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And our second half-hour guest, Mr. Dick Williams, the director and star of Big Time Buck White, calling in from New York. And we'll take our next call from New York again. Miss Gandy is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Miss Gandy?
Yes.
Good evening.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Is this Mr. Williams?
Yeah, right here.
Hi. What I wanted to know, have you visited other workshops in New York, other black workshops?
And you're right. Go ahead.
Go ahead. And if you have, you know, do you find that that you were more freer working there? I mean, free to express than the ones right here in New York, you know?
Well, he hasn't been in New York too long, so I don't know how much time he's had.
Right. Well, I've been around to a few, and one in Bedford-Stuyvesant area, and I've seen the New Lafayette Theater.
Yeah.
And I'm very much impressed with what they're doing. They were doing works that are written, directed, and acted by black people with black technicians, and they're directing their works to black people. And there's a kind of... there's a vitality. There's a very dynamic thing happening in that theater. Very much impressed with it. Now, most of my experience in the black areas at Los Angeles has been with my own workshops. Before I did the play, then I was involved with six black acting, directing, dancing, singing, poetry workshops, you know, that I had formulated myself and that I was doing for nothing, you know, and not charging to come to. And I was getting a great deal out of it. It was as much I got more back, I felt, than my students got back. Plus, I was working with several black organizations in the Watts Ghetto and around the Watts Ghetto. And there's a very, very free thing happening there. I think the freedom is about, you know, if I use the New Lafayette Theater as a standard here, I'd say that it's about the same.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Mr. Williams, what is the purpose of blacks becoming involved in the theater today? Is it to develop a new concept for black performers in terms of expression, or is it an attempt to just become polished enough so that they can become a part of the growing, very interesting Broadway scene as well as the Hollywood scene?
Well, you know, with blacks, there's like that dual thing happening. Some are, you know, going for the Broadway scene, and some are, and I think the more vital ones, the more important ones, are trying to develop their work out of a black reference instead of a white reference. And that's why I believe that there's a dire need for black writers, for black directors, and for black actors who are able to act out of a black reference. You know, so many of the actors have been white-oriented in terms of their teaching that, you know, all of a sudden that when they're calling for contemporary roles, you know, to play black men, they're finding some difficulty in it, you know. And what I see happening too many times is that black actors, there's no difference in the acting at all, except that, you know, their color is different. And what a black actor has to use is that black evolvement, his whole black, his whole experience of moment by moment being a black man, which, you know, no white person can teach them. And I think this is developing in most of the black workshops I've been in.
Well, does this mean that a black performer will not be able to accept a white role unless he refers to his black heritage or to his black reference?
Well, now, that depends. That changes, you know, whether you're referring to television and movies or the stage. On the stage, you know, you might be called upon to do a white role, you know, and, they're different kind of, you know, schools of thinking here, you know, many, many different. My particular school of thinking is that, you know, if you are a black man, then you are obviously a black man. And that I play a lot of white roles, a lot of, you know, Shakespearean roles, blackly, you know, out of a black ethos. And I get some criticism from there, but I get some criticism for about everything that I do. But the point being that, you know, some people feel that it's a black man should not play a Shakespeare because they break the whole illusion, you know. Well, what happens is that sometimes the audience is stunned the first couple of moments, but after when the play goes on, the action, if you've got a vital play with a vital activity going on, then that doesn't bother them at all, you know. And I think that if now Shakespeare wrote in English, and if an English-speaking black man can't play Shakespeare, then I don't think a German can translate the work into other words and then play it, you know. Or a Russian can translate the English version of Shakespeare, the English original version of Shakespeare, into Russian and then play it, impose, you know, the Russian culture on it, you know. I think ultimately, but we've got to go a long way before we can get there, the roles will be interchangeable. An actor will, the job will be to act. And I think also that ultimately that American theater should reflect the culture that it evolves out of. It should reflect that varied culture, that culture that contains black, red, yellow, and white men and women. And, go ahead.
I was going to ask about the breakdown of blacks and whites who have seen Big Time Buck White. Has there been a large percentage of blacks?
Yes, we're drawing blacks. We're drawing maybe 40% black. And that's very good for where we are, you know. And I'm doing everything within my power to increase that because, you know, my work has always been directed to black people, and it just happens that in this particular play that there's something that whites get something out of it too, and so it draws, you know, quite a few whites. But the brothers and the sisters are coming out, and they're having a ball, I think.
We'll take our next call from Mrs. Peterson, who's hearing Night Call over WLIB FM here in New York. Mrs. Peterson.
Sir, hello.
Hello.
Well, I did call you some time ago. I think maybe you remember I said I have a book that was written in 1913 by the scientist in Russia defining why white man is white, why black man is black. You remember?
You called me, ma'am?
I think so. Mr. Shields.
Yes.
Well, anyway, I tell you, I'm trying to translate it, but I don't know who's going to publish it. Origin of white man is the North Pole. The sun never rises there, and 7 months a year it's black. And when during the middle of the winter, even the bears hide themselves in the snow, and the white man had nothing to eat but nothing except his children. And why black man is black, he is from the equator, where sun never sets, where minerals, vegetation, everything, 1,000%. And the white man's culture comes from Africa. Don't you remember me talking to you about it?
No, I don't recall, and I'd like to give you some help on it.
I have the book, and it's written by maybe 20, 30 scientists. But I would like to have somebody in on it because we have to spend lots of time translating it.
Well,
for instance, like steel. I was born in Europe, and nobody knows the origin of metal steel. It's Africa. And you know how they sharpen the knife with a large stone?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what Africans did millions of years ago.
Well, if you're asking for substantiation on the theories espoused in the book, my suggestion would be to get in touch with a gentleman by the name of Mr. Lerone Bennett at Ebony Magazine, or perhaps Dr. Henry Clark here in New York. And if you drop us a note here, we'll pass it on to them, and perhaps they may come up with...
I think it's very, very important, because, you know, black people don't like to be called black. They don't like to be called Negroes, because...
I don't think you're quite right there, ma'am. Black people are accepting the fact now that we are black.
Oh, you ought to see the fight I had with the men on the corner here. You know, Nigeria, in English, it's spelled Nigeria. The French part is Niger. And that's where the slaves officially came from, Niger. And it became Niger.
Well, you drop us a note at Night Call in Pomona, New York, 10970, and we'll pass your request on to some historians, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling. We have enough time to go out to Indianapolis, Indiana. Mr. Banks is hearing Night Call over WTLC-FM. Mr. Banks?
Yes, sir. Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
All right, sir. I have a question here for Mr. Williams.
He's on the line, sir.
All right, sir. The American experience forces black people to really be actors in the pragmatic sense in coping with an unreal scene that white people have thrown them in. And I wanted to know, in plays that relate to black and white reality, and you have black people acting white roles, you find that the dramatic ability of black people is a lot more versatile and a lot broader than that of white people, and that they're both able to relate to black reality as well as white reality, having to relate to white reality because of a necessity here in America.
I'm not sure that I fully understand the question.
Do you find that black people can better act white than white people can better act black?
Oh yeah, well that comes because we've had a whole history of all the communication media being almost totally white. That, you turn on television, it's white. You go to a movie, it's white. And the only black that was permitted was a black, was the stereotype person that, that they would allow in menial roles, the butler, the waiter, and the newspapers have always been white, and the magazines have always been white, and our history books have always been white, and the little children that they write about in kindergarten have been white, So we are very much, we've worked in white homes, we've nursed white kids, we've been in all their personal arguments and discussion in most intimate areas, and we know about them. They don't know about us. And what happens is when you get a white person giving their conception of what a black person is by acting a black role, then they usually do something that's degrading to the black person out of their lack of experience, their ignorance, And that's one of the reasons why I feel that the television and film media have a grave responsibility to black people, because they are in great part responsible for the perpetuation of this large white image.
Mr. Banks, thank you so much for calling, sir.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Williams, I want to thank you so very much for being with us tonight for the second half hour, and also for calling in during the time we had Mr. Schulberg on. And we want to wish you the very best in the big time Buck White, and also want to wish you the very best and great success in the new motion picture Uptight, which will be opening, I think, next week here in New York. So good luck to you.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much.
All right.
This is Del Shields in New York. Tonight we've had a chance to converse with Bud Schulberg from Hollywood and also Dick Williams right here from New York. Thank you for being with us. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, film critic Judith Crist on Rating the Movies. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.